It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, it's our monthly check of science news with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak. Today, we'll learn about some groundbreaking new cancer research.
First, we take a look at a new twist in the battle over net neutrality and the future of the Internet. Earlier this year, FCC regulations over net neutrality, basically the idea that all Internet traffic should be treated equally without fast lanes and slow lanes for certain users, were struck down, leading to fears that service providers might start charging more for certain kinds of traffic.
Today, President Obama is weighing in. He's called on the FCC to enforce more robust regulations on net neutrality, and to do so, he'd like to see the agency reclassify broadband in order to regulate it more like a public utility. So what would that look like, and is it something that the FCC would actually sign off on?
Joining us now is Barry Orton, professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the president spoke out today, coming out strongly in favor of net neutrality. What did he say?
He basically said that the net neutrality is basically fundamental to the people's right to know. And he kind of connected it to the First Amendment, which is a good thing. But he's only one voice in this fight, and maybe not the most important voice.
Right. So technically, the president doesn't actually have sway over the FCC.
No.
Given that, though, how important was this statement of his?
Well, he appoints the chair and he appoints all the members, but by law, two of the members have to be one party and three another. But it was interesting, the response from FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler was the following, among other things. He said he agrees that the Internet must remain open. We both oppose Internet fast lanes, etc. But then he said, as an independent regulatory agency, we will incorporate the president's submission into the record of the open Internet proceedings. We welcome comment on it and how it proposes to use Title II of the Communications Act. So, i.e., he's one person who spoke. There's a million people who've spoken so far, and we'll put it into the record. So that's all they did.
So this Title II of the Telecommunications Act, what would that mean using that particular?
That essentially says that the Internet is like the telephone lines, and it becomes a common carrier. And Title II means that it would be essentially regulated as the FCC regulates phone lines, which is how the Internet started in the first place.
All right, so classifying
it's really not that big of a change, but the industries who profit from the Internet, particularly the carriers, Comcast, Time Warner, AT&T, Verizon, are screaming as if this is the worst possible thing that could ever happen. And quite frankly, their voices are quite loud and have quite a bit of impact. I don't know if you've noticed, but Ted Cruz has come out and said, net neutrality is Obamacare for the Internet. The Internet should not operate at the speed of government. So he's already said, and the Republicans are already starting to kind of pile on and say, well, if Obama said it, it's got to be wrong, and so therefore we're against it.
So if this were to happen, if the Internet would be regulated like a public utility, what would broadband Internet look like under this proposal?
It should look very much the same as it looks right now. You pay for Internet service, and then you get as much as you want to watch. And all the stuff comes in equally. Common carrier means that you treat all things that are the same, so you can't speed up Netflix and slow down YouTube. And that's what net neutrality is really all about. It's about competitive advantage for various providers and various carriers.
Now let's take a look at the two sides here. The companies you just mentioned, companies like Verizon and Comcast, and President Obama's concerns, where do they both stand here?
Well, the carriers stand for a much weaker version of net neutrality. It's called Part 706 of the Communications Act, which basically allows the FCC power to do pretty much what it wants to do, but it doesn't have the specific legal authority that Title II does, which is a standard part of the FCC's powers. It's really not challengeable in court. When the AT&T writes a letter and says they don't like Title II, it would change everything, it would negatively impact our infrastructure and our investment, they're complaining an awful lot about something that they've done very well under over the last 20 years. They essentially don't want to have the FCC to have this power over what they see is a tremendous profit center.
And at the core of President Obama's concerns, what is he trying to prevent from happening?
He's trying to prevent fast lanes. He's trying to prevent a internet that really is a tiered structure where those who pay more get more, and those who pay less get something that's lower, essentially. And speed is what the internet's about these days, and a slower internet doesn't work as well. So he's trying to prevent kind of a class structure within the internet.
President Obama has said he also wants mobile broadband included in this.
Right.
So as it stands, how is mobile broadband regulated differently than traditional broadband?
At the moment, mobile broadband isn't regulated very heavily. And so the regulation basically is structured on who uses the airwaves, the ability to use certain frequencies. And it doesn't go anywhere beyond that. The fear by the companies who provide it is that they would have a government agency that's going to really kind of dictate to them the terms and conditions under which they offer their services. And that's, in fact, what common carriage is about, is that the government says these things have to be equal. There can't be these kinds of differential structures. As to what's going to happen, we have to remember that the chairman of the FCC made his fortune in the telecom industry, and before that, he was the chief lobbyist first for the cable industry and then for the wireless industry. I think when push comes to shove, you're going to find that the industry voices who have spent an awful lot of money over the last number of years supporting campaigns for Congress will be listened to the strongest. I suspect we'll have some kind of a Band-Aid system, which is kind of a blended system where some will be regulated and some won't. But I think the industry voices, which the Republican Party is starting to listen to very strongly, will have great sway here.
And we just heard in the NPR newscast that stocks for iCarriers of broadband, places like Charter, Time Warner, are down 4%. Does that lend credence to either side of this argument?
It lends credence to the idea that the marketplace understands that these guys have had a really great monopoly, more or less, and have a really tremendous business. And here, the threat that we might have a more robust net neutrality kind of takes some of the glow off that business, but it's only 3 to 5%. They're still tremendous businesses, no matter how much they're regulated. And so I think that's probably a correct adjustment in terms of the odds of what will happen here. But quite frankly, even if the FCC agrees with the president and goes full bore for net neutrality, the industry has two very good roads to go after that. One is they can sue, and they can go back into the courts, and they've done that successfully over the many years. And two, they'll go right to Congress and get a new law passed that gives them the upper hand. And I suspect that's what's going to happen.
Now, you mentioned the increasing politicization of this, and the Republicans, you say, increasingly listening to some of these broadband carriers, President Obama weighing in. So is this essentially going to be, a showdown for Democrats and Republicans?
I don't think so. I suspect that when and if the FCC decides to go with a robust model of common carriage, both parties will find that their campaign contributors will lean towards less regulation, and the Congress can very simply pass a new law that says these guys aren't regulatable. And I think in this case, the large contributions that the industries have been making to both parties will pay off for them in many fold.
Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That was Barry Orton, professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about President Obama's recent proposal to protect net neutrality.
New cancer research about a gene mutation will be published early next month, and we're getting a preview of some of the info in our monthly check-in on Science Headlines with Gemma Tarlak.
Gemma is Senior Associate Editor of Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to break down some of the coolest science headlines. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Hello, and a happy Monday to you both.
And to you. Well, let's start with the cover story of the December issue of Discover. It's called The Cave of the Crystal Maiden. Well, that sounds intriguing. What's going on there?
Yes. You know, this is the Indiana Jones movie they should have made. This is a great story where our writer, Will Hunt, actually goes with the researcher into these caves. He's like swimming through subterranean rivers and lightless areas to find this 1,000-year-old skeleton that was the victim of a Maya sacrifice. And he, the researcher unravels the story using research from all different fields to figure out that the Maya were actually going sometimes miles and underground into these like caves that had rivers and cliffs and were absolutely lightless to sacrifice animals and also humans. And they figured out the reason they're doing this is because at the time, we're talking about 1,100 years ago, it was just as the Maya civilization was collapsing, and there was a horrific drought. So you're thinking, why are they dragging all these, you know, people and animals and everything into these lightless, horrible caves to sacrifice them? And it turns out their rain god, Chuck, lived in the caves. So it's this incredible kind of archaeological CSI where the researcher from the University of California at Merced kind of pieces together exactly how this poor 20-year-old woman wound up, you know, a quarter mile underground sacrificed. And it's a riveting story, and we've got some fantastic photos with it as well.
And do we know why this rain god lived underground? Is that something the archaeologists have figured out?
Well,
seems like you
know,
want the rain god up above somewhere.
You know, that's the thing about gods. They just do what they want, right? You know, they live where they want. But seriously, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy. And part of it was Chuck, who is the rain god, is associated with the Mayan underworld. And because, you know, he could be a bad guy with the lightning strikes and the flooding and everything. So he was kind of a, you know, feared creature. And he lived on the edge of the underworld. So they think that's why the Mayas thought of him as living in this cave environment. But it's a crazy story. And one of the things when I was looking at the story that really stood out to me is we have a great map that shows both the elevation and just the whole topography, if that's the right word, of the cave system. And when you see what these people had to go through, you know, hundreds of years before flashlights, just to get to this spot, you can just really sense their desperation to make it rain.
Now, this is kind of a gruesome question, but how did she die?
They killed her dead. You know, there's been a lot of research done on her skeleton, and I don't want to get into the specifics here.
I see. All right. Mysterious.
Fair enough. A bigger question, though, was you mentioned this is a drought, a long-term drought. Was this some sort of early climate change or just a drift in weather patterns that led to this? Do we know what led to this crisis?
To the crisis of the drought?
Yeah.
Well, what she did was she looked at other researchers' work into this 17-year-long study that just wrapped a few years ago, looking at sediment cores and tree rings and all these different elements. And they just know that there was a sharp and severe drop in rainfall at the beginning of the 9th century. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it was definitely a change in pattern, and there are all kinds of theories about that, but it's unmistakable. There's no question that there was this real horrible drought.
Moving on to a topic that's very personal for you now, cancer research.
Yeah, we have also a profile of this fantastic researcher, Joanne Wiethaus, who is just relocating her lab to UCLA now. She was at Yale previously. And she's been doing some really amazing work. And as it turns out, the reason I know about her work is because I'm one of the participants in a study. She does a lot of studies into this specific mutation that increases your risk for cancer. And I'm a cancer survivor myself, and my way of kind of like giving back, or as I like to put it, getting back at cancer, is to participate in these studies and just, you know, share my medical information and history in hopes that it can help research in general.
And then her research focuses on one particular gene mutation, is that right?
Yes, she and her cohort, I guess that's the word, Frank Slack, another biologist, they discovered a few years ago this specific mutation called the KRAS variant. And, you know, there's a lot of press about the BRCA, BRCA 1 and 2 breast cancer mutations. And we think of that kind of as a really bad thing because it really changes your breast cancer risk. Well, to put it all in perspective, the BRCA 1 and 2 mutations are found in 1 in 400 people. They do increase your risk of, say, breast cancer, but they're found in 1 in 400 people. But this KRAS variant, the thing Joanne and Frank discovered, it's found in 1 in 20 of us, which, I mean, when you think about the difference, 1 in 400 versus 1 in 20, there's a lot more KRAS variant mutation going around.
So what happens when you have, when you're one of these 1 in 20, you have this KRAS variant, what does it signify?
Well, there's the technical side and then the risk side. So the technical side of it is it means your body cannot control the production of a certain protein, and that out-of-control production can lead to tumor growth. So that's the technical, actually, science behind the scenes, what happens. Now, what does that mean to the average person? Well, if you have the KRAS variant, you're at a much higher risk for a lot of different kinds of cancer. And we go into it in a lot of different greater depth in the magazine, but basically, for example, having the KRAS variant mutation increases a woman's risk of ovarian cancer by more than 27%. It's also found in a lot of really unfortunate people who have multiple types of cancer. It's a very high likelihood that they are KRAS variant positive. And it also, it can affect, having the KRAS variant can affect how well certain types of chemotherapy work on your cancer. So it's a key thing to know, and unfortunately they're having trouble getting it accepted as a standard practice.
So if it were accepted as a standard practice, how would this affect treatment for people who have this biomarker, this KRAS variant?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, for example, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, one of the first things they did was they put me through a whole barrage of tests looking for specific genetic mutations and specific identifying factors of the actual tumor. And if KRAS variant became standard practice, they would also be checking patients for that, checking to see if they have that variant. And then, for example, not to get too technical, but say platinum-based chemotherapy, it's one form of treatment. It's shown to be not as effective if you have the KRAS variant. So maybe instead of using that as the first option for chemotherapy, your doctor might try something else. And, you know, the science is very new. They're still, as you mentioned when introducing the topic, she's just presenting some of this at a conference next month in San Antonio. So it's all very new, but it is really fascinating. And I think it's going to really impact a lot of lives.
One interesting angle on this is that Dr. Wiedhaus has had the opportunity more than once to sell the rights to this test to various companies. And she has said no because she wants it to be widely available.
Yes, and you know, that's kind of really speaks to her personality. One of the things I really noticed when I was working with her as a study participant is she personally answers all your emails. And mind you, she had no idea I was a member of the media at the time. I was just, you know, patient 123781 or whatever. But she has a lot of personal interaction and a lot of dedication and real passion for this topic. And, you know, she doesn't want the test to cost $5,000, $6,000 like some of the other tests out there. It costs about $300. And she formed a nonprofit group recently, a nonprofit company, and, you know, anyone can get the test. You do have to order it through your doctor, and it's your doctor who gets the results, but she really wants to make it as accessible as possible to people who could use the information.
And there's been a long-term hunt for, I think at first we thought there might be a cancer gene, and now it seems like we're looking for lots of different cancer genes and indicators and things like that. In the scope of all those out there, is this one a big deal?
You know, I really think it is. And, you know, in the course of my day, I see a lot of journal articles, a lot of, you know, we found this, we found that mutation. And what to me is really striking that she has conducted studies with more than 65,000 people. And this keeps cropping up. I don't know numbers of other studies offhand, but I'm pretty sure this is one of the biggest overall examinations of a potentially cancer-causing mutation. And, you know, she keeps coming up to the same findings. So that to me says that this is really big. Personally, I think it's a bigger deal than, say, BRCA 1 or 2, which, again, get a lot of media attention. Some people call them the Angelina Jolie gene because she unfortunately has the BRCA mutation. But I think this is a big deal, and I think people should know about it. You know, whether or not they want to get tested, hey, that's totally up to them. But I think it's very important to know about.
Gemma, in our last moments here, should people who maybe have a history seek out this test? Is that advisable right now?
Well, I'm not a doctor, and I don't even play one on TV. I think that's something you might want to pick up the December issue and take it to your doctor and have a serious discussion. Quite frankly, that's what I did when I saw my doctor recently. I kind of harassed him and said, read this article. And then he immediately flipped to the back page and started reading 20 things you don't know. So I don't know how seriously he took it. But I think it's really worthwhile to read the article, think about, you know, your family history, cancer if you have one, and make that choice.
Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Always fun, guys. See you next month.
That was Gemma Tarlak with Discover Magazine. And you can see Discover's list, by the way, of recommended holiday books. We've got a link on the Central Time Facebook page. We look at one of the latest sports and fitness crazes, obstacle course racing, where participants shimmy through mud pits, crawl under barbed wire, or endure icy blasts from a hose. If it sounds like exercise-induced torture, it kind of is, but it's also the fastest-growing sport in U.S. history, according to our next guest. She spent a year training and competing in several of these races. She's here to talk about her experiences.
Erin Barasini is a reporter for Outside Magazine and the author of Off Course, Inside the Mad, Muddy World of Obstacle Course Racing. She joins us from KPCC Studios in Pasadena, California. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So describe these for us, if you can. What exactly is an obstacle course race?
So there's a lot of different types of obstacle course races, but your basic race will have lots of mud, some monkey bars, barbed wire maybe, ropes to climb up, just a lot of fun obstacles in either anything as short as a 5K up to marathon length and beyond.
And the other variables in the races, sounds like they can get pretty crazy. I was reading about electric shocks and Spartans wielding things that they clobber you with. Tell us about that stuff.
Absolutely. Some of the obstacles that are a little crazier have been very good for making obstacle racing blow up just because it made it more visible. Tough Mudder's flagship obstacle is probably electroshock therapy, which is a field of dangling wires that is almost always the last obstacle before the finish line, that are juiced up with 10,000 volts of electricity. And you have to run through them.
And people sign up to do these things. They pay, hundreds of dollars, right?
Upwards of $100 a race, yeah. It can get pricey a little bit.
So what is the appeal there? Why are people signing up to do this?
I think a lot of it has to do with just the camaraderie that you don't find in any other race. Especially at Tough Mudder, the obstacles are super engineered and they're really big, and it's hard to overcome them on your own, and you need the help of other people, whether that be teammates that you gathered to do the race together or strangers that you meet and become your friends out on the course. And that's something that doesn't happen at like a 10K or a marathon. That's very much an individual endeavor.
Probably if you've done one of these, if you know someone who has, you get it. But if you don't, you're going, what? Why would people do this? But give us a sense of just how big this sport has gotten.
This is pretty amazing. In the last 5 years since obstacle racing was really born, this year more than 4 million people are supposed to do some sort of obstacle race or one of their crazy offshoots like a color run or a foam fest or a zombie run and stuff like that. So that is, just to put it in perspective, I think about 500,000 people will do a marathon this year. So that's 8 times as many people will be doing an obstacle race.
Now, you have done these yourself. Can you tell us about your very first obstacle course run?
My first race was a tiny 5K outside of Sacramento on this farm. And I was just destroyed from doing some ultra triathlon races and looking for something to to get me excited about racing again, and my best friend had told me about obstacle racing, so this was the next race happening somewhere near me. So I drove 6 hours up north and did this 5K in my husband's cross-country spikes that were like three sizes too big, and just had a blast. There was a lot of mud going through watery tunnels, and there's an inflatable water slide, which is super fun. And it was just like, unlike anything I'd ever done before. There were a lot of people in costume and a lot of people of all different levels of sports. I don't know how to say it. There was just anyone from like super hardcore marathoners to people who had never even run a 5K before. And that was just the coolest mix of people to see doing the same race together.
Well, that's interesting, because if you're going to run, say, a triathlon, you really have to be well-trained. You have to be an actual athlete. Can you do one of these courses and just be someone who's out to have a good time?
Absolutely. It might take you a little longer than some of the hardcore athletes, but there's nothing wrong with that. And Tough Mudder encourages that because they have no timing system. So you're not racing against the clock, and you can just go out there and have a good time and not worry about how long it's taking you. And other races offer timing, but you don't have to enter in the elite waves where people are really competitive. If you go in later waves during the day, you can just go out there, walk the course, make it through all the obstacles, and just have a great time.
I'd like to hear more about where these races came from. I know there are a couple different branches, the Spartan races and the Tough Mudders. I mean, who are these people who thought, you know what, running is not hard enough. We need to make it even more difficult, and other people would agree. Why do we need this, and where did it come from?
Well, the people behind two of the biggest obstacle race companies, Spartan Race and Tough Mudder, are pretty fascinating. Joe DeSena was, he still is, kind of a Wall Street businessman who has a farm out in Vermont. And he was a hardcore endurance athlete who had done something like 12 Ironmans in 1 year, in addition to a bunch of other crazy races. And he just thought that they were too straightforward. Like, you knew what was coming when you did an Ironman, and there's the set distances, and you can pretty much prepare for it. And he liked the idea that you'd be out there and have something thrown at you that you maybe didn't prepare in particular for. In the early Spartan races, like before you cross the finish line, they'd hand you a Rubik's Cube that you had to finish. So you could have been first, and if you couldn't finish that Rubik's Cube, you would have lost the race. Will Dean, on the other side, with Tough Mudder, his organization is a little more controversial. He's been accused of stealing the idea from a septuagenarian in the UK who started a race called Tough Guy in 1986. And he had been in actual wars, and he had thought of these ideas, including the electric shocks, because to him it was important that you really reach down inside and get to your lowest point to really find out who you are and what you're made of. So that was what drove him to create Tough Guy. That was kind of a blueprint for Tough Mudder and the electric shock obstacles.
Well, let's talk about the military angle, because, you know, if you look at the popularity of another fitness craze, CrossFit, there seems to be this sort of untapped, or I guess it's being tapped now, but desire for people to know what it's like to go through training in the military and to have that sort of discipline in a way. Is that part of the appeal here, that sort of military angle?
Oh, absolutely. And in the beginning of obstacle racing, maybe in the first year or so, a lot of the racers were in their 20s. So a lot of them had grown up in a very militarized culture with the United States at war, with images projected constantly of soldiers coming home and reuniting with their dogs and everything. So there's definitely a fascination with what's going on away. And I had talked to a sociologist who said that we're more likely to play soldier when we don't have to be. So it's exciting to go out and kind of see what it's like for them, knowing that you're not going to get sent overseas.
How dangerous are these things? Because you talk about electric shocks and somebody bludgeoning you with a stick. It doesn't sound that safe. I mean, a triathlon is dangerous in its own way, but are these things, you know, going to hurt us?
Actually, it's kind of funny. I would say the safety record for obstacle racing is better than at most other races. There hasn't been that many deaths. There was one death at a Tough Mudder last year that was a drowning in one of the obstacles. But out of 4 million people to only have that death, it's pretty remarkable. Triathlon has a much higher death rate, which is a sad thing to say, but they have more water going on, and that's usually where it happens. As far as injuries go, you probably won't leave without a bruise or two, but usually that's it. Mostly it's not the obstacles causing injuries. It's just kind of not paying attention to your footing in between the obstacles, where most people twist ankles, which is the most popular thing to hurt when you're out there.
Well, we're talking right now to sports journalist Erin Veracini about her new book, Off Course, Inside the Mad, Muddy World of Obstacle Course Racing.
And we're taking your calls. Have you ever competed in one of these obstacle races, a Tough Mudder or Spartan Race or any other endurance sport like this? What was it like? How did you train? Would you ever do it again? And what drew you to this kind of competition? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion with sports journalist Erin Veracini about her new book, Off Course, Inside the Mad, Muddy World of Obstacle Course Racing.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these obstacle course races, things like Tough Mudder or Spartan Races? Have you done one of them or a color run? What was it like? How did you train? Why did you do it? Would you do it again? Call in and share your questions, your thoughts, your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go now to our callers. Melissa joins us first in Madison. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question. I'm looking for some advice or motivation to do one of these obstacle races. I've never done one. I've done a few shorter races in the past, but I've looked into it. I've thought about it. What would be the best one to start with, and what are some words of wisdom or motivation to get me to actually sign up for one?
Okay, thanks, Melissa. Melissa's wanting a little pep talk here about why she should do it. What would you say?
Oh, man, there's so many wonderful reasons. I would say start with a warrior dash or a Spartan Race sprint. They're both about 5K in length. And grab some of your best friends and just go out there and have a blast. You don't even have to run them if you don't want to. Don't even worry about time. And take your time on the obstacles and just enjoy them. It's so much fun. And a lot of pro obstacle racers love to say that it just makes them feel like being a kid again. It gives you permission to go out there and play in the mud for a reason and just have a blast. So hopefully that will get you out there. I would come race with you if that would help.
All right, Melissa, good luck to you. And Erin, you had an experience where the joy had sort of gone out of athletics for you. You'd done Ironman and some really serious stuff before. What is it about these races that brought back the joy and the fun for you?
I think a lot of it had to do with trying something new and getting to race with people instead of against people. I still love racing, don't get me wrong. But especially like when I did the Spartan Ultra Beast, that was my first Spartan race, actually. And just being out there, I met people. Like, I made friends that are still my friends today from being out on the course. And that I've made friends at races before, don't get me wrong, but like not while you're racing, usually not talking about people. And I met this guy from Boston who makes cookies, you know, like that wouldn't happen at a triathlon.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to move on next to Paul in Milwaukee. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Actually, it wasn't a question. You guys had asked for people to call in, say, if you've done some of these obstacle course racing, and and what type of training you've done and your kind of general feel on it. I was just going to say I've done the Tough Mudder, and what I was interested was that we actually did it as a team. We got together a group of people, and some of the people, like the person you're talking to, is saying that you just kind of meet people. I ended up being on a team. I didn't know anybody except for one person, and that person ended up backing out because they got injured. So I was racing on a team with, you know, three other guys, and our whole goal was just to help everybody through the obstacles, you know, either over the walls or, I mean, it was 13 miles of running with like 20 obstacles, and there were two electrical components to it. It was the last one, and then there was something called the electric eel, where you had to crawl on your belly through mud with these little things dangling down and zapping you. So, but the way we trained for it, a lot of us were just running and then heading to playgrounds and working on the monkey bars and doing body weight stuff.
So
it was a lot of fun. It was what I was going to say is also actually the guy that's on the Men's Health Fitness, Noah Galloway, he made the cover, and he's actually a big racer in the obstacle course racing. And I was also just going to bring up if you wanted to talk about the world championship obstacle course racing that you just had in Ohio, I believe it was. So that's it.
Can I ask you a quick question? So
sure.
You did the electric eel thing where the dangling wires were shocking you. How bad was that? It doesn't sound,
great. What was bad? It wouldn't have been bad if it went in like one or two shocks, but you're crawling on your belly through, and you're behind people. And some of these people are experiencing a shock for the first time. And not saying that I go out and get shocked all the time, but if you live next to a person who has horses, they have electric fences, so you've felt that a couple times. But people will stop, and so sometimes you're stuck there getting shocked multiple times. I would say I got shocked about 10 times, and it wasn't fun. And that's probably one of my least favorite parts of the Tough Mudder was the electric eel. The last part of it, running through that one, that wasn't too bad. But it was that electric eel that, you know, you think about it, like, I don't want to do it again.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks for shedding some light on your experience there. And those electric shocks. So Paul says his least favorite part, they're seeming pretty standard in some of these races. There have been incidences that you write about in your book, Aaron, where there have been some health repercussions from them, right?
Yes. There was a race in which people had gone to the ER from the race, and the ER doctor kind of compiled a list of what had happened. And it seemed like maybe four of the people that had gone there may have had evidence of some kind of, I don't want to say a full-on heart attack, but it definitely affected them a little bit. I would say that for me, the shocks felt like a giant rubber band whacking me in the back. But it's just Tough Mudder that has the electric shock obstacles. So if that's what's keeping you from obstacle racing, there are plenty of other opportunities where you will not be faced with electric shocks.
Okay, well, thank you to Paul. And we're going to move on next to Jackie in Hillsborough. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
My siblings and I, I'm one of five, and some of our significant others and girlfriends and the like, and a really close friend, competed, if you can say competed, in the Tough Mudder in Plymouth this last fall. It was amazing. It was a wonderful experience. It was super positive. Everyone we met along the way was very encouraging for all of us. Some of us are not as in shape as others. And everyone we met on the course was like, way to go. You guys are doing a great job. Keep it up. And it's such a team-minded experience, and it was unbelievable. We didn't train really, per se. We're all farmers, so that was our training. We're working outside every day. And I'd say that was the biggest help, that we do physical labor on a daily basis. But I would recommend it to anyone who is even slightly interested. And the electric fence thing, yeah, you get over that. It's fun.
Well, I want to ask you, Jackie, did you feel like you got a little bit of that, the experience that some of the founders were talking about of reaching down and finding a reserve in yourself when you hit bottom?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, because I probably hit bottom at about mile 10, and we still had to go a few more miles. And that was part of being on a good team and being with family and being with friends and seeing the people around you. And they're like, you can do this. You can do this. And we'd walk a little bit and we'd run. And you don't know what you're made of until you try to do something like that. And having accomplished it and coming back home and saying to my kids what I did and showing them pictures on YouTube blew their mind that their mom could do that, for one. And the fence thing, of course, amazed them. But it just gives you a whole new level of confidence in yourself.
Okay, thanks, Jack. You got some cred with your kids. That's always good. And I'm curious, Aaron, do other people feel the same way? Do they generally finish one of these things and think that it was fun and want to do it again? Or are there people out there who say, you know, that was just not fun at all. It was miserable and I'm never doing it again.
I don't think I've met anyone that felt like they never wanted to do one again, ever. I think a lot of people come out, or they go into it maybe not knowing what to expect and come out of it just thrilled at their accomplishment. The photos from these things are amazing and make the best Facebook profile photos ever. I mean, no, it's kind of a cool badge of honor to have a picture of yourself crawling under barbed wire all muddy and just out there doing something outside for your health and for fun.
Now, I want to get in a little bit to the long-term future of the sport. Americans, you know, they can be pretty fickle when it comes to physical activities. Right now, as we said, CrossFit is one that's really in right now. So are these obstacle course races. But we do tend to jump from fad to fad pretty quickly. Do you see a real sustainable future for these races, like, you know, say the triathlon?
I see a real effort to try to make them sustainable. I know Joe DeSena and Spartan Race are adamant about trying to get obstacle racing into the Olympics. So they have formed a committee working on that, and they're trying to figure out how to regulate the sport a little bit so it could be an Olympic event without taking away the spirit of it, that kind of renegade spirit. So that's a tough thing to accomplish, but that's definitely something they're working on. Triathlon has a United States governing body, and obstacle racing has just formed one. I don't remember what it's called, but the obstacle racing governing body, a lot like USAT, that will help races with insurance and tackling all that stuff to ensure that smaller races can keep popping up and that people who want to race will have the opportunity.
Now, right now, these examples we've talked about, the electric aspects of it, the jumping into freezing water and getting hit with a stick, that all sounds pretty edgy, but is there a move to push the envelope even further?
I don't think so. I don't think that anybody wants to push these obstacles in a way that would keep people from coming. So I think there are some races where if you want it to be edgier, you can. There's a race called the Death Race that is held in Vermont on the founder of Spartan Race's farm that can last up to 72 plus hours long.
Oh boy.
There's a winter one and a summer one. So if you really do want to push it, there is that opportunity.
Okay, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this world with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Aaron Barasini, reporter for Outside Magazine. She's the author of the new book, Off Course Inside the Mad, Muddy World of Obstacle Course Racing. She joined us from KPCC Studios in Pasadena, California.
So we're going to start a central time team here? Maybe just the
I don't
producers.
Think so.
Yeah.
Just the producers.